from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Sam Hirschman.
This week on War News Radio, Systems of Law, we learn about the Raymond Davis case and the implications of Islamic and secular law.
Then, we hear about Shepherds of Helmand, a recently released documentary about the war in Afghanistan.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Iraqi officials have uncovered a mass grave in the western Anbar province. The grave contains the bodies of more than 800 people believed to have been executed under Saddam Hussein's rule. Human Rights Minister Mohamed Sudani stated that the graves contained the bodies of men, women, and children who had been killed by gunshots to the head. The remains in the graves are being sent to the Health Ministry, where they will be examined and matched with the names of missing people from the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War.
The Iraqi government's recent decision to ban protests on the streets of Baghdad has been criticized throughout the country. The government issued an edict restricting rallies in Baghdad to three main sports stadiums in the city. Protests of the lack of basic services in the country, such as electricity, have increased in frequency since the February uprisings in Tunisia and across the Middle East. Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose Sadr bloc is part of the government, harshly criticized the ban along with many lawmakers. The government, however, has not enforced the ban. When protesters gathered in Tahrir Square last week, no one was arrested.
The Independent, a British newspaper, recently broke a story revealing that leading up to the Iraq invasion, several meetings took place between the British government and British oil companies. The Independent published parts of secret papers, including minutes of meetings between oil executives and government officials. The documents were obtained under Freedom of Information lawsuits by Greg Muddett, who is publishing a book next week on the British government's interests in Iraq's oil. The new evidence from the secret papers suggests that the British government spoke with oil companies about how to exploit Iraq's oil reserves as early as 5 months before deciding to join the U.S. in invading Iraq.
The Afghan government announced plans to take over the management of Kabul Bank, Afghanistan's largest private bank. The first responsibility of the private commission in charge of the overhaul is to recuperate the hundreds of millions of dollars lent out by the bank to its own shareholders. These fraudulent loans, much of which went to President Hamid Karzai's inner circle, make up the vast majority of the bank's holdings, and only 5% have been repaid. The original shareholders will be stripped of their ownership, and the bank will be sold on the open market. Depositors rushed to withdraw their money last fall after news of the bad loans surfaced, causing the International Monetary Fund to revoke support of Afghanistan. Now those debtors that do not repay will be prosecuted, and the International Monetary Fund has agreed to resume assistance. President Karzai blames the lack of oversight by Western auditing agencies, though Afghanistan itself has no legal bank regulation.
The UN Office on Drugs and Crimes released a new report assessing the trends for Afghan opium production. The report finds that four provinces in Afghanistan that were previously poppy-free are currently once again cultivating opium. Last year, when an unknown blight damaged half of Afghanistan's opium crop, opium prices more than doubled. This created a huge incentive for farmers to cultivate opium instead of more traditional crops. However, in Helmand, a province where about half of Afghanistan's opium is grown, there has been a slight decrease in opium production. This is expected to counterbalance the substantial increases in opium production in other parts of the country. The report credits the governor of Helmand Province with preventing increased opium production there. He set up a program that supported farmers who chose to grow more traditional crops, such as wheat.
On April 15th, Kandahar Police Chief Khan Mohammed Mujahid was killed in a suicide explosion at police headquarters in Kandahar City. The attack was the first of three similar incidents over the next few days in which an insurgent, dressed in an Afghan security forces uniform, infiltrated a tightly secured area to carry out an attack. Five NATO troops and Afghan soldiers were killed after a similarly dressed bomber targeted a routine meeting in the headquarters of the Afghan 201 Corps in eastern Afghanistan. Another insurgent with an explosive vest broke into the Defense Ministry headquarters in Kabul, killing at least two with gunfire before he was fatally shot. The Taliban has announced its plan to infiltrate and target the armed forces, and claims that it has agents waiting among the ranks of the Afghan army and police.
Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that there was a link between Pakistan intelligence and anti-U.S. militants. The Directorate of Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, is Pakistan's military intelligence agency. During his two-day trip to the country, Admiral Mullen told a Pakistani news channel that he believed the ISI held a relationship with the Haqqani Network, which is a faction of the Taliban. Admiral Mullen's remarks further strained U.S.-Pakistan relations, which have already been weakened by the case of CIA contractor Raymond Davis, who shot two Pakistanis earlier this year.
Speaker of the House John Boehner recently returned from a two-day trip to Afghanistan. Boehner led a six-member delegation comprised of members of the House Armed Services and House Intelligence Committees. The delegation met with U.S. and Afghan leaders, including General David Petraeus, Ambassador Carl Eikenberry, and President Hamid Karzai. Speaker Boehner also took the trip as an opportunity to express opposition to President Obama's plan to begin pulling out U.S. troops in July.
Late last month, Clay Hunt, a veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, committed suicide at his apartment in Sugarland, Texas. Hunt was awarded a Purple Heart in 2007 after being shot by a sniper in Iraq. After he returned home, he became an advocate and lobbyist for veterans' rights. More specifically, he worked for public awareness of the psychological issues that veterans often face, such as post-traumatic stress disorder. As part of this work, Hunt appeared in an anti-suicide public awareness campaign. Hunt himself suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, having witnessed the deaths of four close friends, including his bunkmate, while serving in the military. Clay Hunt was 28.
Last month, Raymond Davis, a CIA contract worker, was released from a Pakistani prison after being charged with double homicide and spending nearly 3 months in captivity. Though the U.S. government argued that Davis should have been released because he was an embassy employee with diplomatic immunity, his release was ultimately brought about by a promise of monetary compensation. Alan Zhao and John McMinn looked into how diplomacy and Sharia law interacted throughout this crisis. Here's John.
With respect to Mr. Davis, our diplomat in Pakistan, we've got a very simple principle here, that every country in the world that is party to the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations has upheld in the past and should uphold in the future. And that is, if our diplomats are in another country, then they are not subject to that country's local prosecution. We respect it with respect to diplomats who are here. We expect Pakistan, that's a signatory, and recognize Mr. Davis as a diplomat, to abide by this same convention. You know, for those who aren't familiar with the background on this, a couple of Pakistanis were killed in an incident between Mr. Davis in Pakistan. So, obviously, we're concerned about the loss of life. We're not callous about that. But there's a broader principle at stake that I think we have to uphold.
Over the past several months, the saga of Raymond Davis revealed just how strained U.S.-Pakistani relations truly are. Pakistan has long served as an essential ally in the fight against the Taliban. The U.S. sent billions of dollars in military and economic aid since 2001 in exchange for Pakistani cooperation in hunting down the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces. In recent years, the U.S. increased drone missile strikes in the Pakistani tribal regions to target Taliban and Al-Qaeda operatives who have been using the areas as a safe haven. Such strikes are extremely unpopular in Pakistan, causing Pakistani officials to publicly condemn the attacks, even if privately allowing such operations. On January 27, 2011, an incident involving an American named Raymond Davis left two men dead in Lahore, Pakistan, setting off a diplomatic crisis. Though U.S. officials maintained that Davis was an employee of the U.S. Embassy, Western media sources identified him as a former U.S. Special Forces soldier and Blackwater employee under contract with the CIA. Making matters worse, a car dispatched by the U.S. to assist Davis struck and killed an additional civilian. The U.S. strongly pressured the Pakistani government to hand over Davis, arguing that as an embassy employee, he was protected by diplomatic immunity. Professor John Quigley from the Moritz School of Law at Ohio State University explains more about how the concept of diplomatic immunity functions and why so much is at stake in determining the exact nature of Davis's employment at the U.S. Embassy.
Well, in general, persons who hold diplomatic posts are considered immune from the jurisdiction of local courts, meaning that they can't be sued by anyone there. They can't be prosecuted criminally. You know, even if they commit multiple murders, they can't be prosecuted. And the idea for that is to ensure that the sending state, in the jargon of diplomatic law, is able to carry out its functions in the receiving state without impediments from the side of the receiving state. That immunity applies not only to those who are what one ordinarily thinks of as diplomats, and the term that's used is administrative and technical personnel. And in the Raymond Davis situation, the United States eventually claimed that he was in that category of administrative and technical personnel.
However, as Dr. Quigley explains, not all foreign officials qualify.
Another possibility is that he was connected with the consulate in Lahore, in which case he probably would not enjoy diplomatic immunity because consular officials are not immune from prosecution.
The Pakistani government hesitated to grant Davis diplomatic immunity due to allegations that he was connected to covert CIA operations, which remain a highly contentious issue inside Pakistan. However, Professor Quigley reveals that such covert operations are not entirely at odds with normal diplomatic procedures.
If the United States is sending people into Pakistan in this situation, doing things that it's not informing Pakistan about, then it's very questionable as to whether that's appropriate diplomatic activity. Now, it is true that one of the traditional functions of embassies is information collection about the receiving state. So to a certain degree, that is accepted in the international community. And even if the person is an employee of the CIA covertly, if he in fact has been accepted as administrative and technical personnel, then he would enjoy diplomatic immunity.
How the case would have played out in Pakistani civil court will never be known, since Davis was released mid-trial after nearly 3 months of imprisonment. Despite the initial focus on diplomatic rights, the monetary settlement given to the victims' families caused some to wonder if the U.S. considered Sharia law or Islamic law in resolving the case. Tariq Al-Jamil, an associate professor of religion and Islamic studies at Swarthmore College, Warner's Radio's parent organization, explains the history of Sharia law in Pakistan.
Even at the very founding of Pakistan, it was controversial among some circles as to how much Sharia law would be a part of the new constitutional system. And there have been efforts made over the past 60 or so years to, in fact, increase the degree of Sharia present in the government. And, of course, there's been an equal pushback against it.
In 2009, the Pakistani government agreed to a controversial peace deal with Taliban leaders, allowing Sharia law to be enforced in the Taliban-controlled Swat Valley. On a local level, Sharia law is becoming more of a reality throughout certain areas in northern Pakistan. For Davis, relief came only after a local judge acquitted him once all 11 members of the victims' families agreed to pardon him, following secret negotiations between U.S. and Pakistani officials that resulted in a promise of $2.4 million in blood money to the families.
The term itself is a dia, or diat. The heirs of a victim would be compensated in some way as an alternative to forms of punishments that were prevalent in the pre-Islamic period, in which the family would seek retribution in this case, life for life.
But applying Islamic law, like diyat, to foreigners is a much more complicated concept, as Sharia law tends to prescribe solutions between individuals rather than countries.
The compensation tends to be structured around a person's personal status in relationship to Islam. So there's no general principle about how to deal with foreigners, but it's based upon one's relationship to Islam, at least in the Sharia.
The Davis case presented a new set of hurdles for U.S. officials who are accustomed to dealing directly with Pakistani officials, where the U.S. can traditionally flex its diplomatic muscles. Dr. Quigley explains more.
The whole system of diplomatic immunity is based on the notion of reciprocity, and I think it's based on an assumption of equality among states, which in fact does not exist. The power relationship is often quite relevant. The United States can typically get away with more in this realm than, say, Pakistan could if it had operatives in the United States.
The public outcry in Pakistan surrounding the Davis case limited the U.S.'s ability to apply its diplomatic power to achieve its goals, causing the U.S. to operate through alternative Sharia channels. Dr. Al-Jamil describes the potential benefits of operating through Sharia channels.
It does point to an example of how the Sharia can actually solve a conflict that is much more challenging in a kind of constitutional-based governmental system that is not Sharia-based. But this case, I think, highlights that, mm-hmm. where the idea of simply paying retribution was probably better than the kind of holding him in the long period of trial and so forth that he would have faced if he remained in the Pakistani legal system.
The debate about the role of Sharia law in Islamic societies continues. In the Davis case, the U.S. interacted with the Sharia practices of Pakistan when traditional diplomatic power relations failed in the face of public outcry throughout the nation. For Al-Jamil, the importance of Sharia law makes it a potentially useful tool for U.S. diplomats, given its importance in the region. But the current understanding of Sharia is misrepresented by the Taliban stereotypes.
And we see a kind of very crude representation of Sharia-based principles among extremist groups, like the Taliban and others, who would have a very, very narrow idea of what constitutes the Sharia. In many ways, they are similar to some of the detractors coming from America, the Americas, and Europe, in that they both have a very, very narrow perception of what constitutes the Sharia.
But the specific issues in the Davis case are only a small part in a much larger debate over covert operations in Pakistan. Dr. Quigley suggests that the use of diplomatic law to protect covert operations may ultimately be counterproductive in the long run for the U.S.
It probably does harm the United States substantially that we are engaging in this kind of activity. I mean, you can see the reaction that's come about in Pakistan to this situation. And these kinds of incidents, of course, occur against the whole background of colonialism. And I mean, even if the United States, you know, was not itself a colonial power in Pakistan, that probably doesn't matter too much in terms of the local perception. And I think that we run a great risk of anti-American terrorism coming out of this kind of activity. How much good it does, that is, if you want to do a cost-benefit analysis, I'm not sure where that comes down. I tend to think we're probably doing more harm than good.
While the Davis case has technically been resolved through the settlement with the Pakistani families, the uproar over U.S. operations in Pakistan continues. Last week, the New York Times reported that top Pakistani officials had demanded a limit to the number of covert operatives in Pakistan and a halt to drone strikes. This comes after Pakistanis continue to protest the U.S. role in their nation and the rising number of civilian casualties connected to U.S. operations. This week, U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, met with Pakistani officials in an attempt to ease tensions between the two nations. However, following the meeting, Mullen accused the Pakistani intelligence service of maintaining ties with the Taliban inside Pakistan. Pakistani officials adamantly deny the accusation, calling it negative propaganda, as relations show no sign of improving. For War News Radio, I'm John McMinn.
is War News Radio. The ongoing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have spawned numerous war documentaries. Gary Mortensen's 2007 film, This Is War, Memories of Iraq, was critically acclaimed for focusing on the soldier's perspective. Director Mortensen's new documentary, Shepherds of Helmand, uses the same approach to tell the story of an Oregonian National Guard unit deployed to Afghanistan in 2008. Alan Zhao and my co-host Jared Nolan have more in this piece, first aired in March. Here's Jared.
When we got there, Shao Ali was talking to me, and one of the things that he said to me that struck me funny, and he says, "Tell me, Captain, tell me, what will you tell me about war?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm not here to tell you about war, so I'm here to teach you how to do all this stuff." He says, "Really?" He says, "Well, let me give you some of my background. I fought against the Russians for 8 years in the Russian-Afghan War. And then I fought against the Taliban in the Afghan Civil War. And for the past 3 years, I've been fighting for you Americans against the Taliban. Now tell me, Captain, what will you tell me about war?"
That's from the trailer of the recently released documentary Shepherds of Helmand. Speaking was Major Dominic Odo, one of 17 volunteers from the Oregon National Guard deployed to Afghanistan. The film was directed by Gary Mortensen, whose vision was to produce the most authentic portrayal of a soldier's experience in Afghanistan. He accomplished this goal in two ways. First, the film did not include any on-location camera work by Mortensen. Rather, the soldiers themselves captured all the video. Then, back in the United States, Mortensen talked to the guardsmen directly for their commentary on the events they recorded. Mortensen describes the process.
"This really follows six soldiers, and then as much as possible used all of their photographs and film to, when they're talking about something, to take you there. Again, it feels very authentic, because it is. I mean, taking a camera over myself would have been gorgeous, right, with a nice high-definition camera and all that. But I'd also suggest that it wouldn't be as authentic. These guys with NOAA cameras on them. So a year later, they'd actually hadn't been back quite a year when they agreed to sit down with me and tell me their stories. So I got 30 hours of interviews and then 10,000 photos and, I don't know, 20 or 30 hours of video to sift through and just try to make a living document of their experience."
The footage is even more immediate because soldiers didn't know their video would be used in a documentary. It's simply what they felt should be recorded. First Sergeant David Hagen, one of the six soldiers featured in the documentary, explains the soldiers' motivation behind capturing the war.
Partly because we wanted something to keep. Part of it was morbid curiosity. And to be honest with you, there are a couple of those pieces of film that were taken quite literally because we ran out of ammunition. We were waiting for an ammo resupply, so in the absence of anything better to do, we filmed the war.
In earlier wars, this type of documentation simply wasn't possible, according to Mortensen.
"Almost every soldier that goes over there has some form of recording device now. And what you're getting, in my opinion, with the YouTube generation now, is you're getting the most raw and authentic glimpse into the life of a soldier that we've ever had. We're getting to see things from a soldier's perspective that we've only hinted at in the past."
All of the guardsmen in the unit volunteered to deploy to Afghanistan. Sergeant Hagen describes his decision to volunteer as a simple fulfillment of mission.
Volunteered to go to Afghanistan because regardless of what my beliefs on Iraq were, I believed that Afghanistan was a just war. And personally speaking, we wear a uniform for one reason and one reason only, and that is to deploy. And I was an infantry instructor. I was training soldiers to go serve in the role of infantry in a wartime environment. So I didn't feel that it was fair for me to, I couldn't give them a fair assessment and a fair shake as an instructor until I had been there and knew what I was talking about. So I volunteered to go over, one, because I felt it was a just war. Two, I think that the only reason that we're in the military is in the absence of diplomacy, we're used to deploy. And we shut down the aggression. That is our job. And I truly believe that the Afghan war was something that I needed to do.
Once there, the unit quickly realized the dangers of their mission to train an Afghan battalion and establish a presence in Helmand.
Almost every day they were attacked. And the Taliban had the base ranged in with mortars so they could mortar it whenever they wanted. In fact, to make it even worse, they believe that at least 10 of the 125 Afghan soldiers in their base were Taliban, including the company commander. The Taliban are also fanatically committed to seeing one of these bases overrun, and the interpreters have ICOM radios, and they could hear the Taliban chatting, and that's they're casually talking about, we're going to go up and overrun that base and kill everybody.
Both military and civilian viewers have voiced positive responses. Sergeant Hagen describes the difference between the two audiences.
The military community have got a tremendous response from a lot of people saying they heard that our experiences over there were pretty dramatic, and after they saw the film, they've given certain praise to the fact that we made it out of there alive. And the reaction I've gotten from civilians were they had no idea that was going on over there.
For Mortensen, the approval of a general audience was not the most important reaction.
With this film, there's really only six people I've ever really cared that they approve of, and that's the six guys in the film. And I told them if it's not authentic to them, then I won't release it. If it's not authentic to them, if there's something that I portray that is not accurate, then I'll fix it, because it's their story, not mine.
Sergeant Hagen believes that Shepherds of Helmand is a story of men, without any overarching messages.
I think it's a message of 17 Oregonians going over there, and it's really just our experience. Each one of us had a different experience, and each of us came home with different perspectives. But really, it's just not the day in the life of a soldier, but the experiences in a wartime environment, how we bond together and how we live together and how we changed from beginning to end.
Mortensen says he believes it is this unfiltered focus that allows the film to be more accessible by a civilian audience.
I want people to be open-minded when they watch a film like this. You know, it's a war film. It's a documentary, but it's really, I didn't make it to be a war film. I made this about Americans. It's about our neighbors. It's about our family. And something that they've done that's quite extraordinary. I'm a big believer that, you know, the soldiers need to have a voice. They need to be heard. And so many times we're hearing someone else is speaking on behalf of the soldiers. You know, they're saying, this is what they're doing, this is what they're thinking, or this is what's going on. Well, you know, I just want to hear from the soldiers.
Shepherds of Helmand is not currently commercially distributed, but it can be ordered from the film's website, shepherdsofhelmand.org. Half of the revenue from the film goes to Honored American Veterans Afield, a nonprofit organization dedicated to sponsoring outdoor sports events for disabled veterans. For War News Radio, with Alan Zhao, I'm Jared Nolan. That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Lewis Katz, Rosanna Kim, Amandine Lee, Jeremy Rappaport-Stein, and Chloe Wittenberg. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Sam Hirschman. Until next time, thanks for listening.